They're not. Let's see. Mr. Johnson, you're up first for Mr. Espinal. Whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Maximo Espinal was arrested and charged with aggravated assault merely for doing his job as a commissioned security officer. Despite being charged at by an unknown trespassing vehicle, he kept the muzzle of his duty shotgun pointed at the ground at all times. From the safety of his unmarked police vehicle, Appellee Long's life was never in imminent danger, and he felt safe enough to roll down his window to verbally engage with Max after he had charged him with his vehicle. There is no possible construction of these facts in which a reasonable officer could believe that an assault had occurred. Judge Hughes's vague ruling below sets a dangerous precedent that would expose any weapon-carrying security guard to liability for assault. That must be corrected for three reasons. First, Appellee Long never faced an imminent threat of bodily harm from Max's actions.
Is that really required for an aggravated? What is the charge? Aggravated assault?
Is it
enough to brandish a dangerous weapon?
The statutory language is an imminent threat of bodily harm. There have been some state law cases which were not briefed about individuals brandishing private weapons, but none about security guards with duty weapons or police officers.
Well, I mean, so in this kind of case, let's stipulate that there wasn't probable cause to arrest, but that's not enough to overcome qualified immunity, right?
Correct. It would need to be there's no arguable probable cause.
Yeah. So maybe there was a misunderstanding about, you know, whether the security guard, you know, had the right to be carrying a shotgun, about the way that he brandished it, about his interaction with the police. And so, you know, how can you say that beyond being lacking in probable cause, it was so unreasonable as to overcome qualified immunity? I guess that's my concern.
Your Honor, I have two responses to that. The first one is just a pushback on the use of the term brandishing. Appellees use that term a lot, but in the complaint itself, all it says is that he gripped his duty shotgun at the lobe ready and kept the muzzle pointed at the ground.
Well,
that's not exactly brandishing.
Well, okay. Well, all right.
With due respect, brandishing has some level of movement or some level of something beyond just holding it, is my first response. And my second response to that is, even if Appellee Long wasn't aware of the requirements of a commissioned security officer and what weapons they are or not able to carry. And that, first of all, that's not an arrestable offense in and of itself in terms of carrying the wrong duty weapon. But secondly, even if he was wrong on the law, that wouldn't then create arguable probable cause from the perspective of a reasonable police officer. But in addition to that, we can look at the district court's opinion. The reasons that the district court gave for saying that there was arguable probable cause are very vague and don't really apply the facts of the law. All the district court says is that there was aggravated assault, quote, given the position of Espinal's firearm and the nature of the sides exchange. As we just talked about, the position of Espinal's firearm was pointed at the ground. He was holding it.
Is it disputed or undisputed that at the same time as he's holding the shotgun pointed down, he says, leave and don't come back to a police officer?
I don't believe that quote was ever in the complaint. So if that quote is proffered at any point, then yes, that's disputed.
I thought it was recited in Judge Hughes's opinion.
I would need to double check that, Your Honor, but I don't believe that was ever in the complaint.
I agree with you. Judge Hughes doesn't develop Texas law, and I'm certainly not familiar with when you can arrest Texans who have guns. I'm not, you know, that's probably a pretty high level. But there is a totally independent ground, correct? He's saying, well, qualified immunity, because after this happened, the grand jury immunized it. And we do have the independent intermediary doctrine. And I think your brief said, well, that's got to happen before the incident. But that isn't our law, right?
No. So
what's your answer to that independent basis for granting qualified immunity?
Right. So two answers to your question. The first is just a clarification of the briefing, which is not that the independent intermediary needed to act before the arrest, because of course the independent intermediary can apply to a grand jury after the fact. But the point that was made in the brief was merely about he didn't have a warrant beforehand. So the standard of how a police officer should act without a warrant is what applies to his actions on the scene. And in terms of the independent intermediary after the fact, we have, and we can look at your opinion in Wilson versus Stroman, to see that, you know, grand jury proceedings are secret. So there's only so much that plaintiff can infer and plaintiff can know. So based on the facts that are pled, we can see that, you know, it doesn't even take a reasonable inference to see that based on these facts, if accurately presented.
So your argument for reversal on application of the independent intermediary is that in your complaint you allege taint. Is that what you're arguing?
Not precisely, Your Honor. Okay. I'm saying what the facts in the complaint show is that if these facts are accurately presented to a grand jury, that it would be a facially deficient presentation of facts, that no grand jury, that there's no probable cause that a grand jury could use to submit an indictment. What I'm asking this court to make, though, is a reasonable inference that even if, if there was an indictment, that even if the facts weren't accurately presented, that it wouldn't necessarily rely on misstatements or omissions by Officer Law.
I don't understand.
That in order for the...
Yeah,
in order,
I don't understand. I thought the intermediate that doctrine you just referred to with the multisyllabic name, that doctrine, I thought it required either omission of pertinent facts from what's presented to the intermediary, or just sort of falsehoods, right? Don't you need that? Don't you need some sort of taint, as Judge Higginson said, in order to show that the intermediary doesn't immunize?
Right. So the level of taint can come from two sources. Like you're saying, there's the Franks exception, which is material misstatements or omissions.
Yes.
The second is a Malley deficiency, which is presenting a facially deficient affidavit,
okay.
Or facially
All right.
deficient evidence.
You're saying these facts that are alleged in the complaint that led to his arrest are presented to the grand jury. It's so bad,
right,
that the grand jury couldn't reasonably return an indictment.
Right, that it's either by necessity facially deficient or...
You cite Wilson v. Stroman?
Excuse me?
Wilson v. Stroman. I thought you were citing McClinn.
I was...
Maybe I'm wrong.
I was citing...
The context usually for the Malley claim is we've got the affidavit that gets the arrest warrant.
Right.
That's not these facts. We have the black box, which admittedly is a problem in the doctrine, but the doctrine is what it is. So I would have thought the MCLIN case, Macklin, tells a complainant that they've got to allege something. And so here's the question for you. What paragraph in the complaint alleges whatever you think it was that misrepresented to the grand jury? What paragraph in the complaint best alleges any misrepresentation?
We don't have a paragraph in the complaint that specifically says that Long misrepresented something to the grand jury.
Or even facially deficient. Where's the paragraph that speaks to that issue?
Right. So there's not explicit language about any of Long's representations to the grand jury, in large part because they would be inherently speculative.
Right, but we dealt with that in McClinn. Right. In McClinn, they still alleged false affidavits. They still made the allegation that likely so-and-so went in front of the grand jury and misled it. It may seem like a technicality. I agree. Grand juries are black box. So much of this doctrine is open to criticism, but it is binding on us. Let me put that to a question. I often speak and then don't ask a question. Would you agree that the taint alleged in the complaint here is significantly less than it is in McClinn?
I'd argue that it's less.
Fine. That's good. Okay. So it's less. Do you have a case that stands for the independent intermediary doctrine wouldn't apply based on, can you think of a case where this little was alleged?
Not specifically, but, you know, if we're going to dive into the nitty-gritty of the independent intermediary doctrine beyond what's already been briefed, I think that, you know, an opportunity to find more cases that would find where that line is of what needs to be alleged would be required, or in the alternative, if this court decides that the independent intermediary doctrine applies purely because of a pleading deficiency, that it's sent back with the stipulation that it's dismissed without prejudice, so that we have a chance to.
But just to be clear, there's no paragraph right now you would point us to.
Correct.
Okay.
If we can go back to qualified immunity for a second.
Yes.
I think we were talking about prong one, but what about prong two? What case can you point to, assuming we agree with you that there was a violation on the arrest, what case can you point to that clearly established that that was unconstitutional?
Right. So clear establishment, as the briefing shows in with respect to Joseph versus Bartlett and Cooper versus Brown, the real thrust of qualified immunity is whether or not there was a fair warning that what the officer was doing was wrong.
You have to point to a case that's fairly, not directly on point, but that would inform the officers.
Right.
Any officer.
And in addition to that, we have Hope versus Petzler, which says that, you know, an obvious violation.
Okay, that to one side. That's always sort of the last resort. Yeah, but it's obvious. Okay, put that to one side. Can you tell me what's your best case or cases in this situation? Because this, I'll be frank, this is an unusual situation. I haven't seen this particular one.
In terms of the specific facts, there is not frequently these sorts of disagreements between police officers and security guards in cases that I've read as well. I think that in general, U.S. versus Walden, 707 F. 2nd, 129, that's this circuit's case, and Illinois v. Gates, these sorts of cases that deal with showing that officers need to take in the totality of the circumstances and make an objective.
Well, but so typically you don't need a case that's the exact facts. I accept that. But something that is in the ballpark, I guess, that shows an officer who does this is clearly violating the law.
So where I was going with that, so we have the general establishment that you have to look at the whole thing and not just your perspective, and you can't exclude the exculpating factors.
I get all that.
But then if you go beyond that and look at Wilson and look at Malley.
Well, tell me which one of those cases is factually similar enough that it would have put the officer on notice here.
I believe that the cases themselves, the fact that officers are taking, in Wilson, for example, are taking these, making generalities and taking obviously deficient claims where they don't have what they need to make an arrest, and just taking them to a grand jury anyway, I would argue is factually close enough in between that, in between the language of the Fourth Amendment itself. I don't think that there's any reason for Officer Long to have believed that, you know, inventing a charge out of thin air just because he has thin skin was allowable under the Fourth Amendment. I just don't.
Let me ask you a question. Suppose that what happened here is actually the first encounter. This was taken to the grand jury, and the same result.
So, if I might clarify, Your Honor, you're asking if the encounter the first night didn't happen, would the result be different?
Yeah.
Your Honor, no. And that actually.
The grand jury indicted.
One more time, I'm sorry.
And the grand jury taken to the grand jury, and the grand jury indicted.
Right. And what I'm saying is that would not affect the outcome of this case. And if you consider a hypothetical where, you know, Long or the hypothetical reasonable police officer or any of the four of us are sitting in a car and observing this, you know, from afar. You know, we see a security officer holding his duty shotgun lighted in a parking lot by the building that he's hired to protect. You see him charged by an unmarked unknown trespassing vehicle, and all he does is grip his shotgun a little tighter. I don't think any of us, any reasonable police officer, Long himself, absent the fact that he was in the car, would see that and say, an aggravated assault occurred there, and the security officer was the one that did it. So I think that answers basically the same question, insofar as even if the officer didn't have the experience from the night before where he had spoken to Max about you know, his duty weapon, and Max had already said, you know, this is private property. I understand that you're a police officer, but you can't be here. That doesn't necessarily change the fact that the facts that he had in front of him that night alone were enough for him to know that there was no probable cause for aggravated assault. So with that, I'll leave the rest of the time for rebuttal. Thank you,
counsel. Mr. Higginson? I can pronounce that name.
It's spelled differently for me.
Spelled differently.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Higginson, I represent the city and the officers.
You're going to have to talk up a little.
Certainly. I was having trouble hearing over there myself, in fact, so I think there's an acoustical issue, or maybe it's all in my head, I don't know. But may it please the court, I'm Robert Higginson, and I represent the city and the officers. There are three reasons why this court should affirm. First, there was arguable probable cause. Second, qualified immunity covers reasonable mistakes of law or of fact. And third, the grand jury indictment is the independent intermediary doctrine.
Was the officer here just, was he, mis- and I'm just, honest question, I haven't looked at it. Was he mistaken about the kind of weapon that a security officer can have in Texas?
We don't have that information in the record. We don't know if he was mistaken, but it could be a reasonable mistake. If you just look at a Google search of rifles that look like shotguns, will show you that there are rifles that look like shotguns, and there are shotguns that look like rifles. And so it can be a reasonable mistake for him to believe that we don't have the weapon itself in there, and they're seeing it at night, and we don't have, it could be a reasonable mistake for him to believe that this is a rifle. Now, that would be a reasonable mistake of fact. It could be a reasonable mistake of law for him to misunderstand or misremember the statutes that apply to exactly what he as a commissioned officer might be entitled to carry. Now, and there's nothing in there that says that that Officer Long knew that he was a commissioned officer. That's something that came around afterwards. And
well, I suppose that he did have a rifle the whole time. What difference does that make?
According to the statute, apparently it makes some difference whether the security, a commissioned security guard, could handle a rifle as opposed to a shotgun. Presumably because of the distance of the effect, but that's just my assumption.
That's what I was going to add. What is the regulation of the rifle? What is the law regarding the handling of a rifle?
That a commissioned security officer cannot carry a rifle. And so if the officer believed, and I'm saying it's...
I understand the follows from it. I just wanted the legal basis for that.
Yes, and in fact, Mr. Espinel even pleads an acknowledgement that he is legally prohibited from carrying a rifle.
Right.
So that would be
Theory of the case, just so I understand, is Long is driving along at midnight. He's in plain clothes, unmarked.
Yes.
He sees a uniformed security officer. He trespasses.
Yes.
And then arrests him for aggravated assault of him because he thinks he's got a rifle?
Couple more steps.
Okay.
All right. So the first encounter, no. It's the third encounter that's the arrest.
There's a confrontation on the first encounter.
Right? There is. And so from this, if officer, that is supposed to be off my body. I thought that was off.
I thought you were reaching for your shotgun.
Well, you see, it looked like I was, you know, yeah, I'm like.
It's all right. We're,
yes. And so there's a reasonable mistake of fact. And
what are the elements of aggravated assault? What are the elements?
Yes, lovely. I love that you asked that. Let me just actually read them here. And I have this in my brief, and the section is in pages 13 through 20. And I have quoted, first of all, it's a combination of three sections from the Penal Code. Assault itself is in Penal Code Section 20. Just refer to page 15 of my brief. And there are three possible ways that you could commit an assault.
Well, just describe the way that this...
The one that's relevant here is intentionally or knowingly threatening another with imminent bodily injury. We'll stop there because the rest of it doesn't matter. All right. And so that part, and I'll add the other second, the aggravated in the public service that gets it to a felony in a second, if I may. That part about knowingly, intentionally, intentionally or knowingly threatening another with imminent bodily injury is where this could be a reasonable mistake of fact on Officer Long's part. I'm not conceding that it's a mistake because we don't know if it was a threat. But standing with a shotgun at that distance, just a few yards away as Espinal bled, the shotgun would certainly be able to hit him. And they're having an argument. And the officer is saying, you can't have that. And he's saying, in effect, yes, I can. And he's holding it at a low ready. That's not automatically a...
I thought he also said basically to get out of here.
And absolutely, yes. And so there is that part of the argument. It gets a little bit heated. It doesn't apparently last very long.
The records show that exactly what he said, what the testimony was in the record about, he didn't just ask him to leave. He ran him, sort of colloquially, he ran him off and he's holding a gun. So.
Well, exactly right. This is how it's bled, and because we're here on a motion to dismiss as opposed to summary judgment, there's kind of a limit of what's actually in the record. We're just going on what he pled. But these are things that Espinal himself acknowledged in his own complaint, you know, that he told him, you know, you got to leave, get out of here. And this is after he knows that he's a police officer. And so Espinal says, well, all he has is a badge to show, well, all right, that's enough to put him on notice. But then it's also important that we not look at this from the perspective of Espinal as a criminal defendant. He can defend against that charge with certain facts. We're looking at this from the perspective of the officer. What is this man doing who I think is holding a rifle, and he's saying it's not, and he's telling me to get out of here, and this appears to be an angry encounter here, and I still think it's a rifle, and he's holding it like this, and it takes less than a second to get it up and fire. Officers would not be able to defend themselves. Now, we're not even talking about an officer shooting here, but just this is an assault.
I thought Texas law required security officers to display their firearm.
I believe that's correct, but not a rifle. Okay, and so if the officer...
I'm trying to think, and this may be wrong, there may be a secondary argument, but you're asking us to say, and tell me if you've got any Texas aggravated assault case that stands for this, other than the statute, that in Texas, police can trespass onto your property if they see you're holding a gun, whatever gun it is, and then arrest you for aggravated assault, and then they say, well, we thought that was a prohibited gun.
Again, if I may, that's not quite how it worked, because it was three encounters. The third one was the arrest. The second one repeated the get out of here, it's a shotgun.
Well, he leaves, he doesn't arrest him. I guess I am focused on the third encounter. Mm-hmm. And it seems even worse than the hypothetical I threw at you.
All right.
In that this is a security officer that Texas law requires to display the gun. So any Texas police officer can trespass when they see a security officer who's required to display his gun and arrested him because he's displaying the gun.
No, I don't believe that's the case. That's not what I'm arguing, at least. And I don't have a Texas case that says that.
You have any Texas case remotely close to these facts, where there was a conviction affirmed on aggravated assault when the police officer trespasses and the man who has the gun is required to have the gun?
I do not.
And Judge Hughes, it's very, very thin. So if we're affirming on that basis, coming from the Fifth Circuit, right, Judge Hughes' argument is about a paragraph citing zero Texas law.
Right.
But that is the ruling you're asking us to say, that at least on the second prong, it's not clearly established in Texas that you can't do what I just described.
Well, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Yes.
I think there'll be a lot of startled Texans if we say that. Maybe I'm wrong. Is this your primary argument, or what is your primary argument?
The primary argument is that qualified immunity carries the... All right. Well, it's wrapped up in what you're asking me.
Yeah.
That qualified immunity covers the mistake. I believe that there was arguable probable cause here. You could even imagine a possible conversation. This is just imagined. In the car driving back to arrest him. Well, what was he doing with the gun? Was it really a threat? Was he threatening you? Yes, I think he was threatening me. Does this fit with the law? Yes, it does. Does it not? If this is arguable, reasonably arguable, it's covered.
So your primary argument is the one you've made?
Yes. Okay. The secondary argument is the grand jury indictment cuts off the causality. And neither, well, the grand jury doesn't have to be presented with what the plaintiff says is exculpatory evidence. That's something for a later trial jury. A petit jury can deal with that. You don't do all that in the grand jury proceedings. And the bar for probable cause is very low. It's just, you know, if there seems to be some inclination that there, or some evidence that there is a crime that's just been committed or is being committed or is about to be committed, and...
I thought the allegation here is simply is assault. I mean, some crime is being committed. that's why he went back. Also, I thought that the requirement of distinction between rifles and shotguns stems from simple fact that not that the guard shouldn't be well armed. In fact, I think the shotgun is frankly more deadly than the rifle. But the rifle is prohibited because of the area in which these are going to be used, the carry simply of a rifle versus a shotgun.
Yes.
So to me, straight away, I'm not unfamiliar with those weapons. A shotgun, if I'm close enough to shoot you, is a lot more deadly than a rifle. But I'm not sure. What do you do with it struck me that what part was going on here is the actual anger that flared up between these two. What caused that? You said there were three encounters. Can you describe for me briefly how they've escalated, or what is it the record show was the basis for that?
All we have to go on is the allegations and the complaint. And there, the complaint alleges that Mr. Espinal's correction to Officer Long, that this is a shotgun, that Officer Long may have taken offense at that and gotten upset, been embarrassed, or something along those lines. Came back the next night, they had the same kind of encounter the second night. And then he comes back an hour later with others to arrest him. And so it appears that from the complaint that Mr. Espinal is relying to some extent on what he believes to be, what he speculates or might be the motive of Officer Long. But that, this court has held, and the U.S. Supreme Court has held, is irrelevant to the determination of probable cause. And so if there is something here that looks like there may be a crime here, they can arrest him, even if it turns out they're wrong later. And I was, to follow up with where I was earlier, Judge Higginson, and I got a little off track.
He goes back three times. So he knows he's a guard, and he's not a pretender. So he knows then that the man's lawfully possessing a weapon. So it has to be that he was persuaded that the fellow was threatening him with the weapon. Is that fair?
That is, if I understand what you're saying exactly, Judge Higginbotham, that is fair. There's not a problem with the security officer possessing the weapon, even with the requirement that he have it displayed. The problem here is in what is evidently Officer Long's perception that this low ready position, where with a shotgun he could raise it, I mean, that's threatening, or could reasonably be perceived as a threat, even if it was not Mr. Espinal's intention. It could reasonably be perceived as a threat in the context of Espinal's response to Officer Long's directive, you can't have a rifle. And again, we go back to, yes, I agree, a shotgun at close range would be more deadly than a rifle. And there would be other reasons for disallowing or prohibiting the rifle.
Well, to me, the flashpoint becomes, for this purpose, is when he has the, not to whatever moves he may have made with the gun, but that he actually runs him off. He tells him, get out of here. Mm-hmm. And advantage in that sense that if the officer believes he was enforcing his orders to get out of here by brandishing a shotgun, frankly.
Well, I think that's what the
he might very well think he would.
I think that's what the complaint alleges, that he was using the shotgun to enforce the order to leave this place, you know, get out of here. That's how I read it. And that can be reasonably perceived as a threat. Like, if you don't, I'm ready to make you. Talking about this.
Well, the security guard doesn't have that. What's he guess the question? What is the authority of a security guard to order a police officer to depart?
I think that if the police officer has a reason to be there, it's pretty slim authority. Now, let us remember that this is a high crime area. The officer knew this. The security guard knew this. Mr. Espinal says that that's why he was carrying the shotgun. Great. This also offers an explanation for the officer's approach onto this private property. Officers can do that if they see somebody over here and they wonder what's going on.
It's this. Be straightforward with you. It focuses on the reality that we don't know what the presentation to the grand jury was. That's inherent in the system. So we have to, I'm trying to get at what the range of possibilities are that could support that. What was the presentation to the grand jury? If from the facts of it, one could articulate a reasonable interpretation of it, of events that support the officer's viewpoint, then we, under this doctrine, we have to assume that it's what the grand jury was told. And like it or not, that's what the intermediary doctrine, I think, teaches.
I agree with what you're saying, Judge Higginbotham, and we don't know what's in there because, like you said, it's a black box, and we have to deal with that. We cannot infer that they were told something untruthful. They were likely told something that supports their, you know, something that was Officer Long's perception of it. And it could have been a misunderstanding. It could have been just a mistake. I don't think that it goes as far as officers driving by, they see an armed security guard so they can go over and arrest him for assaulting them. The assault comes in what Judge Higginbotham was describing as get out of here, and he's enforcing that with the display of the shotgun. I was starting to cite these three penal code sections that come together. One was
if they're in the brief, we have them. I'm not saying don't.
I'm sorry?
If they're in the brief, we have them. I'm just
you do, exactly right.
You don't feel like you have to recite the brief again.
Okay, it's pages 15 and following in my brief. And one is for assault, which includes the threat. That's where the threat comes from. That makes it an assault. You know, no contact is necessary. Second is it's aggravated if the relevant portion of that is use or exhibit a deadly weapon in the commission of the assault. And then the third, it becomes a first-degree felony. An assault is a first-degree felony if the actor acts against a person the actor knows is a public servant. By that time, it continued after the display of the badge. After he knew he was talking with an officer, he continued doing this and telling him to leave. So that's how this is tied together into probable cause, or at least arguable probable cause. And so that's one reason.
I guess you've said that correctly, and I tried to bring this up with the other side as well. It's not the question is not did he have probable cause. We can stipulate that he did not have probable cause. The question for qualified immunity is whether it was so obvious that he lacked, and I'm paraphrasing, he had to clearly lack probable cause, no reasonable basis for the arrest. Isn't that right?
That's right, Judge Duncan. It doesn't really get that far. There is a way that you could be an officer in that situation and think this guy, reasonably think this guy is committing an offense.
But that would be probable cause. He could be wrong about that.
Even if you're wrong, yes. And so that's where the arguable probable cause, so that's what's even a lower threshold. You know, whether it's actual probable cause, which I believe was there, or arguable probable cause, which is kind of hard to get away from that, it still doesn't matter if in the end there's no probable cause. And the grand jury, from whatever it was that they heard, believed to be probable cause. Furthermore, another thing I just want to mention very quickly is Mr. Espinal makes a couple of references to this videotape that would have been exculpatory, he said. And this court has held in Lavage v. Fight, which I cited in my brief, that allegedly exculpatory evidence, it was a different kind of a case. It wasn't an officer, it was an arrest, but it wasn't, I guess it's comparable enough. Lavage v. Fight, it was officer arrested a man for violating the statutory requirement for reporting on scrap metal purchases. And he said, I can show you all this other reason that I did that. And this court held that that is irrelevant. I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
May it please the court. Couple points on rebuttal. The first I'd like to start with Judge Higginbotham's question right at the beginning of a friend at the other table's presentation, which is I struggle to understand what, let's say Officer Long is making a reasonable mistake that Espinal has a rifle instead of a shotgun. That has nothing to do with whether or not Espinal arguably or did or did not commit an aggravated assault.
Why not? If I'm brandishing a gun, or I'll take it from your complaint, he gripped his shotgun tightly at the low ready, muzzle still pointing to the ground. So I'm gripping the shotgun or rifle, and then I say in paragraph 20, Max told Officer Long to leave, as this was private property, and not to come back, to which Officer Long stated that he was a police officer. It isn't that, even if he's wrong about it being a rifle versus a shotgun, isn't that a threat communicated to a police officer while exhibiting a weapon?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe that that's a threat to a police officer while exhibiting the weapon. Before diving into that, I just wanted to clarify. All I'm getting at is that whether Long thought it was a rifle or a shotgun, it has nothing to do with the offense. Which is what you indicated by your question. If Long thinks he's holding a rifle, if Long thinks he's holding a shotgun, that has nothing to do with probable cause for aggravated assault. So, Long may have believed, even reasonably, based on the appearance of the weapon, that Espinal was holding a rifle, but that wouldn't affect the probable cause determination.
Well, I don't understand that, but I just, okay.
But going back to your question more directly, I think that Judge Higginson's questions really get to the heart of that about, a police officer can see somebody that, it's dark, it's nighttime, he's lighted, he's prominent, he's in his security guard uniform holding a weapon. Why would a police officer then trespass on that property and be able to then arrest for aggravated assault when the person rightfully tells them that they can't be here? What is absent from the complaint?
I mean, look, I'm all for private property and the Fourth Amendment, but if an officer comes onto my property and I don't think he has a right to be there, and I take out a gun and I say, hey, you need to leave, I can do that to the police?
I would say I don't believe that you could do that, provided that you didn't already have a gun out that you were displaying as part of your job. In this case, he is a security officer. He already had it out. It was already displayed. He was already holding it. He didn't pull it out when he was charged with Officer Long's vehicle. But the other thing that I would note is that...
Okay, so in Texas, security guards can exhibit weapons and tell the police menacingly, threateningly, to get off the property.
They can tell police to leave the property if the police have no right to be on the property. But absent from the complaint is any implication that his words or actions were threatening, or even that his emotions were angry or out of hand. The complaint indicates that Long was becoming angry, but not that Espinal was reciprocating that anger. He has every right to inform the officer, this is private property, you're not allowed to be here, there's trespassing signs.
I doubt that
you can leave.
I would doubt that the owner of the property is a viewpoint that they don't want police officers on their property, and they hired security guards to protect it. That doesn't make sense. So your argument, your suggestion that it doesn't make practical, realistic sense that the owner of the property here would, who's not present and so forth, that somehow or another he's trespassing. But I don't think that ultimately takes us anywhere. There are more fundamental problems with it.
Right, and yeah, as you kind of indicated, you know, regardless of the owner's intent of whether or not the owner would want a police officer on the property or not, he was
a police officer would think.
That being what it is, I think the other thing to consider, especially with respect to the fact that, you know, regardless of Long's status as a police officer, he was, police officer or not, a trespasser. So that goes to Espinal's defensive justification. I mean, he had every reason to believe that he was being charged with a vehicle, that somebody was coming onto the property that he was commissioned to protect, and he had every right to defend it. And because he's holding a weapon, doesn't prevent him from being able to perform his duties in that way.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted. We appreciate it. We have one more case for the day. Okay, if we could just post.